Hello and welcome once more to the Port of Solier radio programme on Boat Radio. I'm Shirley Roberts. It's my pleasure today to be here in the Port of Solier talking to Anna Nicholas. Anna Nicholas is a local lady, one of my neighbours, and she's also an author of these parts. And so, Anna, tell us all about your latest book.
Well, it's lovely to be here, Shirley. Thanks so much for inviting me along to Boat Radio. Yes, my latest book is called A Chorus of Cockerels, and the title is very much based on my having 8 cockerels at home and about 40 chickens or hens, and they all have lots of chicks. The book is very much about Solier, but it's equally about a new area of the island for me, although I've been there before, and it's Esplar area of the island, which I've written about. And this is the area known as the agricultural zone. And a lot of Majorcans say there isn't a lot going on there. And we never see much written about it, you know, because when tourists come here, they always go either to the popular areas, like Magaluf, or to Puerto Portales, or they'll come to our neck of the woods, the northwest of the island, to Dea and Solier Valley. So I did a lot of research in the central area to see what exciting things might be there.
And other than potatoes, what did you find?
Well, one of the things I found that I really thought was fascinating were these tiny little museums that are literary museums. There's one in Binissalem, but there's one in a little village called San Juan. And they're run by Fundacio Casa Museum. And they literally are free of charge. And they're literary houses that were once owned by a particular writer from the historic past. And honestly, Shirley, no one knows about them. And I mean, literally no one knows about them. I was talking to the mayor about the Fundacio Casa Museum, and he said, well, where is it? Is it on the mainland? And I said, no, you have it in Mallorca. And I've talked to loads of Mallorcans locally and in Palma, never heard of it. But these are lovely, precious little houses. So you can go and see how one of these writers lived in the 1900s. Go and see how they tended their animals. You go up and down the stairs, see where they slept, look at their works. I mean, admittedly, they're Catalan writers and Mallorca writers. There's Bla Bonet, that's in Santanyi. There's a lovely house owned by a writer called Villalonga in Binissalem. Huge house with a courtyard. It's beautiful. And in San Juan, there's this other gorgeous little house that was owned by Pere Ginard, who was a priest and he became a very famous writer. But also in the main part of the island, and in Arta as well, which I love, there is a museum which is called Art Arta. And if you go to the museum upstairs, it has all these amazing sculptures of fairy tale characters on the island. And they were all created by this sculptor called Pere Pujol. And they're absolutely extraordinary. I mean, grotesque and exciting and fantastical. And it's €1 to go and have a look at these amazing pieces. And I was talking to the lady who owns this museum, and she was a great friend of the sculptor. And she said, no, we don't get many tourists coming here. They don't know about us. And I think that's the story of the Central Pla, because everyone thinks, oh, it's the agricultural zone. There's not a lot going on here. But they've got art museums. They've got amazing churches. I went to Muro, and they've got the most fantastic church there. But the other silly thing I did, but it was good fun, you know these little biscuits they all have, like the Quelli biscuits?
Quelli biscuits, yeah.
Well, I love the ones that are from Muro. And I thought, I wonder what these galletas de Muro are like, and if it's a factory or who owns them. So I went over to Muro. My husband thought I was nuts. And I kept asking people if they knew where the Gori biscuit factory was. And they said, oh, yes, it's that little house over there. So I knocked on the door, went in, and there's this quite elderly chap there. And I said, oh, I'm a fan of your biscuits. And he said, really? So I said, yes, I just wonder if I could look at your factory. And he said, my factory, there's only 5 of us. You know, we're a tiny family business. We just make these biscuits.
Well, some
are
big.
Literally, they have this little factory place, like little ovens behind.
Yeah.
He's quite a shy man as well.
Yeah.
So I think a mad English woman with curly hair running into his factory probably wasn't his idea of fun. But what made me laugh is when I asked him his name, he says his name was Gregory. Did you see? They're Gregory biscuits.
So it
was like the family name all the way back, Gregory. And I loved that. That was so sweet. So, you know, it's just really going around and finding out. You know, we see brands on the street here, and it's just finding out a little bit about them and who ticks, you know, what's behind something. And I love that about the central part of the island.
But the whole adventure, so you start with your cockerels and your hens, then that's back here in Solia, and then you can go on an adventure anywhere around the island and discover all these wonderful things. But what's your link from cockerels to to literary persons in the middle of the island in some back street house where five of them are making biscuits?
Yeah, I know. I call it the missing link. Well, there is a sort of chicken theme running through my book, funnily enough. And yes, I do love hens, but there is a hen theme. I mean, another funny thing is that I actually have to do some work for a charity that looks after, you're going to laugh, that looks after hens that have been abused. You know, these battery hen farms?
Really?
Yes. And they make crochet jackets for the hens.
Okay, yeah.
Right. And they also have flat jackets that are luminous for hens so they don't get run over if they leave the gates, okay, of the farm. So with that in mind, the whole thematic side of cockerels and hens took shape. And then in my quest to get more hens, I met a man in Felonage in the centre of the island who sells exotic hens. I bought some exotic hens off him. So you can see the way my mind works. And so while I was running around the central part of the island, I discovered all these historical things and things like the museums. And then I, after toddling around the island doing all this, I came back to Solia and started thinking about angles to Solia that I find interesting that maybe people don't know about. One of the things I loved about here, you know, we have the UNESCO heritage status now, obviously, of the Tramontanas. But I was talking to some Yorkan friends about how beautiful they are, and they said, "Huh, but did you know in the 17th century it wasn't a bag of laughs?" And I said, "Really?" So I thought, oh, I must investigate that. So I read up a lot about it, and sure enough, in the 17th century, it was so dangerous that if you were walking up in the hills, they had these horrible sort of highwaymen up there that would slit your throat. And they had these dogs called alanos, these large dogs that would terrorize you, basically. And so people didn't go for a nice walk in the hills. So all these little nitbits and facts that I love. And also I went to Dragonair Island, which I've been to before. But that was interesting, learning about Barbarossa, that he used to go there to obviously get his water supplies and hide out in a cave. And I went with a friend right up to the top, a Yorkan friend who's, you know, historian, and he was saying that all the lichen, that, you know, the lichen that grows there, was used in days of yore, in the medieval times, to actually stain the robes of the priests and, you know, the liturgical garments. And he was saying it was an incredible process. So you get these guys, for very little money, peasants, scaling these cliffs. And if you've been to Dragonair, how dangerous it is. And they were desperately trying to get baby falcons because the king loved falconry. So they'd try and take the babies out of their nests. And they were scaling these cliffs with absolutely, you know, nothing to protect them. So many died. And they're also trying to get the lichen because they'd bring it back to Palma and there were these dyeing houses. And at the dyeing houses, they would actually create this dye. And they used urine to act in part of the process. So the smell was absolutely horrendous. So in the end, the king decided that they'd have to take them outside of Palma. So that's why all these dyeing houses are outside the city walls. So I know it's got nothing to do with hens, but basically I start on one premise and end up somewhere else. So it's a sort of potpourri of different historical, geographical facts and things that interest me.
Well, you can do that because this is book number 6.
Yes.
So when you started with your first book, this was really your own adventure and what brought you here to Solia in the first place, would I be right? So tell us the story of the first book and where you came from.
Okay, so with the first book, we've basically been coming over to Mallorca on holiday for many years. Well, not as many as you, actually. But we've been coming over for some years, probably about 5 or 6. And we stayed at La Residencia for a long weekend and then decided we want to come back for a proper holiday, long holiday, not at La Residencia rates. So we hired a little villa and we loved it. We stayed in Poyenza, but Solia was always where our heart was. And then we found the shambolic wreck of a finca and bought it spontaneously, having nicked money from my sister who just sold her house in Kent. She had a lump sum of money while she was waiting to get another house.
Borrowed,
yeah. Well, yes, it was one of those frantic calls saying, "Celia, we've found this house we think is amazing. We haven't got the money for it. You've got some money in your bank account. Would you mind just lending it to us?" She went, "Okay, will I get it back because I need to actually buy another house with it?" And we said, yes. So we went to the bank, persuaded the bank to give us some money so we could buy it, mortgage it. and came back to England. And I was running a PR agency in Mayfair at the time. And we didn't really know why we bought it, thinking, is it investment? Is it for holidays? Are we going to do it up over a lifetime and keep working? Took us a year to get planning permission in those days, so we couldn't do anything with it. So water was streaming in through the roof, things were getting ruined, so that was a bit of a stress. But actually, the more we thought about it that year, we suddenly thought, what are we doing? Why don't we just change our lives and come and live out here? That's honestly what happened. So having done that, we moved out once we started getting basics done with local builders, like the roof and stairs and those sort of boring things that we all have to think about. And when we came out, I was still running the agency, so I'd go back every week on the EasyJet flights that had started regularly, so that I could look after the staff. I had 8 staff. Alan decided, which was wise, that he'd look after Ollie in Mallorca. He took the interesting option, and I was the one on the plane. But when I got on the plane, I noticed that the same people were sitting around me every time I was going back and forth. So we all got talking. Turned out they were all commuters like me, so I thought, that's interesting. So I called it the EasyJet Commuters Club. And so we all got to know each other on first known terms. And it was quite nice. It's like going on the bus, you know, rather than sort of going to work. And so I thought, why doesn't someone write a book about living between two places and having to earn a living? So I don't know about you, but there's a lot of flit lit, as it's called, flit literature. And a lot of it's people who go to live somewhere else, they don't have to earn a living. They just sort of live in the sun. And I always used to think, well, how did they get the money to do it? And what do they do apart from writing books about how lovely the locals are? So I wanted to write a book that was a bit more realistic, saying I still had to earn money to pay the mortgage of the new house. But, you know, just to live, that we weren't going to just retire and do nothing. So that was the premise. So it was really having a foot in both camps, which hadn't really been done that before so much. So that was the premise for the first book. And really talking about how a family adapts with a small child, because Ollie was 4 at the time, our son. How a small child adapts. Do you put them in an international school? Do you put them in a Spanish school? How do you make friends? How do you learn the language? Even basics. And how do you adapt to rural life if you've lived in a central town, wherever it might be in England? So it was all those thoughts I had and trying to run a business at the same time that really was the premise for the first book. So I sort of did a synopsis. I talked to a journalist friend and she recommended a literary agent. Went to the literary agent. A literary agent said, oh, I love it, fantastic, I'll take you on. And I wrote the book and I'd show it to her. And then I got to the, literally, I got to the stage where she took the book, was about to send it out to publishers. And about 2 days later, a friend said, oh, have you seen the front page about your agent in Publishing News and the bookseller? And I said, no. And she said, oh, she's quit the agency. And I went, what? Yes, you haven't read it. And I said, no. So she said, yes, your agent's gone. She's gone to New York. I went, great. Justin, she was going to send my book out. So that was helpful. And then my agent rang me from New York to say, I'm so sorry, but I fell out with the management. She was the MD running William Morris and London at the time. And she'd gone out to start a new agency. And she did offer to take me with her, but I knew that in New York, very few people would know a little place like Mallorca. So I thought, I'm a first-time writer. I'm just going to have to find another literary agent or go and do it myself. And so I had read Summersdale's books. And so I just on spec thought, right, I'm just going to go direct to a publisher. And the rest is history. I mean, luckily, Summersdale came back to me in 3 months, said they had a big editorial process to go through. And then they'd let me know if I got to the next stage. It was all in stages. And after 6 months, the commissioning editor rang me and said, actually, yes, we like your book. You'll have to make a lot of changes because you've got too much based in London. We want more in Mallorca. But if you're prepared to do that, we'll take you on. And so I've been with them ever since, to be honest.
And so that's the story that sets the scene from book one then. So what did you do with the other books as they grew?
So the other books were really, again, you know, about our progress as a family, how we became more integrated in Solia life and in Mallorca life, really. How Ollie progressed in his schooling, how I managed to sort of sever ties with London eventually by merging my agency, which I did. And then doing more of other things like blogging, other writing, freelance writing and book writing. Well, I don't mention that very much, funnily enough.
Which writing?
So, you know, and I've always kept on consultancy and I probably always will. So it was really about having a more balanced life and actually, you know, waking up smelling the coffee and the roses too, rather than just constantly working, which I'd been like before. Bit of a workaholic, to be honest, when I was in London.
But when you are, when that is your personality, does it matter where you live?
It's a very leading question. And you are absolutely right, because I know you work very hard. And, you know, I am the same. I will always work. It doesn't really matter what at. As long as I enjoy what I'm doing, I'm really happy. Sometimes I take on too much and I get very tired, or I think, why did I say yes to that? But then I think if it is your personality, you're right. Wherever you are, you're going to continue in that vein, but maybe not in such a pressurized way. I think I was far more stressed out in London, probably because I had a lot of clients and deadlines. And I think the very nature of being in a big city, don't you, is quite stressful anyway, with the traffic and pollution, and everyone wants everything the next minute. Whereas, as you know, in Mallorca, you can sort of get away with a different pace of life. So I tell you what I do like now is that, you know, when I was working in London, I'd get up early, get Ollie to school, go walk into the office, and I'd be there all hours. And then I worked, you know, at weekends a lot of the time doing big events. But here, I love working from home and pottering around and choosing the hours when I'm going to work. So it might mean that I'll work 4 hours one day and then take a few hours off and then work later in the evening. Or I might say, oh, you know, I'm going to go to do some research tomorrow. I just suit myself more. I don't have the responsibility of staff and thinking, oh my God, I've got 8 staff. I've got to make sure I bring the money in to make sure they've got their salaries. You know, it's all those pressures and paying for offices. So I find that liberating, that I only have myself to worry about, really.
But in the work that you're doing, do you never have to work with other people, though? I mean, because you did quite a bit here for the tourist board, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, yes, that's true. But I did the tourist board quite some time ago. That's when I had the agency, to be honest. I do work with teams, but I like the fact that as a consultant, you go in with a fresh take on everything, so that, you know, if they're not happy with the boss, you can often pick up things. You can pick up things that aren't working in a company or in a hotel, and you can try and feed that information back to the person who's employed you. Not obviously shopping the poor staff, but I think you can go in and be part of that team, but isolate yourself when you need to in order to help them, which I like. I like being slightly divorced from them all.
So the balance of your life, so you're writing a lot, so you're writing books, you're writing articles and in other publications, you're researching, because once you get an idea in your head, you'll take it to the nth degree, and that might end up as an article, and I know that one very well myself. But what's next?
What's next? I wrote a book about 18 months ago, actually, which is a crime novel set in Sollier. And I'm spending this summer, in between all my other things, trying to cut the words down, because it's about 120,000 words. I've got it down to about 105, and I need about another 8,000 to go. And I have an agent in London, and she wants it to be cut further still. So that's what I'm doing this summer. So I'm nearly there. I've only got, yeah, probably another 7,000, and I'm where I need to be.
So who are you basing this genre on then? I mean, which kind of writer? Are you a Scandinavian style writer as far as...
Absolutely not. No, I'll tell you what it is. It's more Agatha Christie. It's very much Miss Marple of the Mountains. A Mallorca character, she's very effervescent fun, and she solves crime intuitively. And so, you know, it's sort of, how would I describe it? More cozy crime. And it's, you know,
cozy crime. I love that. I love that expression. Crime. Cozy crime.
Cozy crime.
Anna Nicholas of cozycrime.com.
I'd like that to be. So, yeah, my character is living in a little village. So it's all, you know, very much about rural life, the Sollier Valley. So that's the idea. And, yeah, a few murders thrown in.
So this is book one. So in your brain, you've gone to book five already.
I've mapped out 3 or 4 already. Yeah.
So we're moving away from rural life and cockerels then now.
No, we're not.
We're not. You've got another one of those coming.
No, because my central character keeps hens. I let you know that.
Right.
And it's in the heart of rural Sollier where she lives. So it's very much about rural life, Mallorca culture, Mallorca values. Yeah, very much, actually very Mallorca in a way. So it's just got a nice story. I hope it's a fun story. And I hope that people get to engage with the characters. I'm saying all this in the hope that it will be published early. But as you probably know, publishing is not easy these days. Getting agents isn't.
Have you got an agent for this?
I have a very nice agent in London now. And they're very good on commercial fiction. So she loves the book, but she needs me to cut the words. Because, you know, you have a certain amount of... 90,000 words is sort of normal number of words for a crime book of my kind, cozy crime. So I was up to about 120, and I've now got it down to about 105. So I'm nearly there.
Don't you find that's really, really hard? When you've laboured over some of these precious words and someone wants to actually take them out, you get very upset with them, don't you?
It is really hard. Really hard. I mean, I do it with articles. You know when they give you a word count, you think, I've got to get that down. That's not so bad. But when it's on a large scale, it is quite hard. The only thing I didn't want to happen is that I would have to cut out bits of the plot, or, you know, have to rewire, because it's quite complicated, my book, very complicated. It's got different strands, different plots going on. But so far, I've just been really hard on myself, and I've cut out bits I like of description or dialogue, and it's amazing how the word count does come down. You've just got to be horribly disciplined, and you've also got to be quite cold on yourself. You know, you've got to be your own best critic.
So what's the time frame of this, then, the realistic time frame of publication, do you think?
Oh, it takes forever. I was talking to an author friend yesterday, and it took her 8 months from the time she handed it in to her agent before she got a publisher. So it's nothing's cut and dried. I'm going to hand it in on the 1st of September, and I imagine that they'll have a look at it. I mean, they've read it anyway, but they'll probably then have a quick edit, and then they'll send it out maybe October. So it's a long process, Shirley. It could be another year.
It could be the beginning of next year or
More towards the end of next year. No, I think, honestly, that's the way it is now. And that's if I'm lucky enough. I mean, you know, it may be that they go out to loads of publishers and they don't like it. They think it's completely insane, or it's too crazy, or a bit esoteric. You have to be very phlegmatic in this business. Yeah. And I do think that's why a lot of people self-publish, because they give up. You know, they go to agents. Agents themselves can be very arrogant and very unfriendly towards authors or would-be authors. You know, they've got books. I mean, their books are absolutely filled with authors. So you go to them and they say, oh, God, no, we don't need another one. Or I'm completely filled. I've got 20 authors. Because I get a lot of would-be authors writing to me for advice. And I don't want to put them off, because I think there's always hope. But it is a rocky road. And unless you really want to write a book, I wouldn't advise it, unless you really want to write a book. Unless you don't mind not making money, because you don't make money from books anymore. Very little. So unless you've got a day job, or you think you're going to become a bestseller, you've got to be really sane about whether you want to do writing full time. I mean, it's easy for me because I'm doing other things. You know, I do consultancy, I write articles, I do blog, I do all sorts of things. And I write books, but I couldn't live off writing books. And I think some people get in touch with me and they say, oh, I've written this book and, you know, I want to live off writing now. And they haven't put any work in. They just think it's like a magic wand. And then I have to educate them on how hard work it is. And I don't knock self-publishing, because I think increasingly self-publishers can do quite well. I think the whole gamut of publishing is changing. And I think where the old school used to say, well, if you don't get an agent, you've had it. I think these days that's not the case. Peter Kerr, you know, who wrote a whole series in Mallorca, he emails me quite a bit. And he's been self-publishing for the last 4 books, I think, now. And, okay, you know, I'm sure he just about washes his face with it, I think. But he prefers the control, you know.
But this is because writers feel they've got something to say. And so it's the telling of the story, or the expressing of the opinion and being able to do that, is such a gift that you don't want to stop doing it, even if you don't get any money from it. I mean, but financially, if you had to have a day job, then the books would become a hobby or not?
I have to be honest, with my books now, I do make money on my books, and it's taken me a long time to get there. So I wouldn't want to go backwards. I think, you know, I have to justify writing my books now. So I get advances from my publisher, so that justifies it for me, and then royalties. But I know people that have spent, I don't know, £6,000 self-publishing because they want to see their book published. And that's fine, but I don't have that sort of money. I can't justify that. I can't justify spending £6,000 on self-publishing on the hope that I will get that money back, because it doesn't make sense to me commercially. It has to make sense to me commercially, or otherwise I just think, well, it's lovely to write it for yourself, but isn't it nice to have an audience too, you know?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, fully agree with that one. And tell us, as far as your life here in the Solly Valley is concerned, I mean, do you find, have you found over the last 10 years, let's say, that the kind of people that have arrived here and have made a contribution have changed?
I'd say they have greatly, actually. I think there are a lot more what I would call working younger families, which I think is great. I think it's very welcome. I think there used to be a lot of retirees, you know, who'd come over, maybe, you know, had some money, they could get a nice house and then just sort of live slightly more expatty life. But I think all that's changing now. I think this is ironic in the middle of what's happened with Brexit, but I think there has been more free movement, which has actually been a great thing, because it means younger families can come and move around, maybe settle in the Solihull Valley, put their kids in a local school, and have opportunities to work business to business, maybe, that they wouldn't have had before. And I think it creates a much more lively, vibrant expat community, where, you know, there are retirees, but there's a mixture. And I like that very much. And I think that they integrate better. I think the kids learn the language. And I hope that will continue. You know, I think there's been a lot of worries over Brexit. I think it's great now we've got a bit more stability with Theresa May at least having been put in a PM position. Hope so. And she was a Remainer after all. But I actually don't think it will affect our sort of status here anyway. You know, a lot of us have been here many years and we'll continue to live here, hopefully. And we're very, you know, in touch with the locals. I think they feel for us, the ones I spoke to really do. And they don't want us to feel insecure here. Something you touched on, I read this week, which I was really interested about because I was going to talk to you about that, is about the Solihull toll tunnel.
Indeed, yeah.
I personally think it's a good thing not to have the toll tunnel. But interestingly, I've talked to people that are very against it, and they just love us living in our own little, you know, Shangri-La.
The island within an island that we live in Solihull. Yeah, that's right.
What's your view on that? Sorry, I'm interviewing you now, but what's your view?
What, my own view about the tunnel?
Yes.
I'm all for free movement. Anyone can, but is more than welcome to come. It's also part of the big game plan, but, you know, we do, there is a plan for this area to reach the 20,000 inhabitants with all the infrastructure that takes place. And so unlike Brexit, there is a plan for what was to happen here once the tunnel came down. And so I think it's a wonderful parallel myself.
No, it is. I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's very sad that there are people that actually are worried about the money, so they don't come to Solihull, you know, but they'd love to see the Tramontanas or go along the Dare Coast, whatever, and they don't want to go over the Col, or they've got young kids. It's very expensive, I think, for families day trippers. You know, when you add it up on top of a meal out and... So no,
I think the people that come here on holiday are probably the least of the worries, because they will spend that €10 on one trip and they will have a trip here. But for local people that want to just use all their island as they want to, I think it's absolutely essential that the tunnel is free. But one thing I'd like to ask you about, actually, because in my own brain, going with the literary connections around here, so all these interesting people come in over the last 10 years. Many of them have come, and they're younger, as you say. But do you think that Solihull is now beginning to mirror what Daya once was? Because you have a Daya connection too, don't you?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting question. I think you could well be right. I think we're becoming the cultural and artistic centre, really. I do think we're the heartland for it. And I was up in Daya at the weekend. I love Daya. You know, I love the scenery. I mean, it's gorgeous, isn't it? But I think it's sad in a way, but a lot of the old artists, musicians are no longer there. And we both know why. I mean, A, some of them are getting older, but it's not just that. It's very expensive up in Daya, and it's become quite an elite place in some ways. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but it has really. To buy property up there is so expensive. So you are getting a different sort of person going. And I'm saying it's good for the infrastructure and for obviously the town hall and roads and so forth. But that bohemian, mad, fun, spontaneous community, I think, is breaking up. You know, I know a lot of that brigade and they're still there, but I think it's tougher for them. I mean, the other day I was talking to someone in Daya and I said, where do you eat? And she said, where do I eat? We don't eat up here, it's too expensive. Apart from one or two caps, you know, lunchtime menu, forget it. We have to come down to Solihull or to Valdemossa because it's so expensive. And I think that's a bit sad, don't you, that you live in a village but you can't afford to eat out because it's so pricey, it's so touristy.
No, I think the fascination of that, certainly some of the interviews of people I've done in Daya, you know, people that used to know every single one of their neighbours now they have fine houses up the road where they've got guards, you know, they've got people that are watching out for them because they're so important. And it's not because they're pop stars, it's not that kind of guarding, but it's large companies and people that are terribly important in particular different spheres of their life. And so that seems to be one of the big changes that people regret.
Do you know what I was shocked at? The beautician was telling me that she goes to a lot of these houses and they all have butlers and they all have live-in staff. And I said, what?
In uniforms.
I couldn't believe it. No, honestly, I really didn't realise that. Well, obviously shows the circus I'm moving, doesn't it?
What staff have you got, Anna? What staff have you got?
Yeah, well, I've got this strange old Scotsman that I see in the garden a lot, cursing me and my chickens at 4 a.m. But no, it's absolutely true, you know, and I think there is a level of wealth that is just incredible, don't you, up there? Yes, I think it's a bit sad. I think there was, and I don't know if you, I mean, the other thing I've noticed is how the shops have increased as well. There's a huge, I mean, it's not commercial centre, but it has become much more commercial. And I think the locals, the local Mallorquins and the local Brits and Australians and Americans are finding it quite difficult just because of the prices and the volume of you know, this new brigade that have come in.
And so that's our gain down here, really, in Solia, in the port of Solia, very much, because every other person that comes in is a very interesting, has a very interesting story to tell, and you just never run out of people to talk to and interview.
And I think it's very down-to-earth place, don't you? I mean, one of the attractions for me about Solia is that it is a working town. I've always said that, and that's one of the reasons we love living here. You go in and everyone's normal. You know, there might be, I don't know, the odd celeb around, but who cares, really? It's just about normal people, whether they're Mallorca or international, enjoying life and, you know, getting on with their business. I love that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's a great moment to wrap up. And thank you very much for your for contributing to Boat Radio today. Thank you, Anna Nicholas.
Thank you.
Smartest long-tail catch you'll find is ho way, ho way, you must hunt. She's the lady say of the salty times. Clear away the track and let the bull jine run to me. Hey, rig a jig, she's a jaunting free.
We're living our dream.
We're living simply and sustainably aboard a sailboat travelling the world.
We're visiting remote communities and raising awareness about the health of our oceans.
Patrolling the oceans for microplastic particles.
We're checking on the health of coral reefs and phytoplankton populations.
We're monitoring marine mammals and examining synthetic materials in fish.
We're Bass and Jamie Van Jones.
And we're proof that citizen science can save the world.
Hear all about our amazing adventures in salty times every week here on Boat Radio.
Stay salty.
You.
And the board of the ladies sing. Clear away the tack and let the boat join run.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames. From the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures, I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.